Welcome, everybody, to Mormons on Mushrooms. Just a reminder that this is a storytelling podcast where we discuss alternative methods for healing from trauma and seeking a more fulfilling life. A lot of times on the podcast, we discuss triggering topics, and we ask that you make your personal mental health top priority. Lastly, the opinions offered by our guests don't necessarily reflect the opinions of the hosts. Sit back, buckle up, and enjoy.
Right. Okay. It's been a minute. And a lot of stuff has happened, and cool stuff is happening today. It's actually a big day for Cody, Alex, and me. And we had planned this episode going to talk to Alex in depth about the magical and psychedelic ties of the Smith family, especially before Joseph Smith was born. And we're going to go into this in a bit. But to give a shout out or to pitch something right away, this is this episode is also announcing that we are having a screening or a weekend of screenings for our documentary that Alex was a part of, and Cody and I have been producing over the last year. The documentary is called Entheomegas. You can get tickets for it at searstonedproductions.com. That's searstoned with a D, productions.com. It will be in the show notes. So we have made a documentary over the last year. It is finished now, and we are showing it to people in Salt Lake the weekend of April 27th, 28th, and 29th. The 27th is a Saturday. 27th and 28th, we're showing it at Natural Law Apothecary. That is Marinda Bowen's Apothecary in downtown Salt Lake. For those of you that are familiar, it's an unforgettable place if you've been there. It's a very cozy place. We're only having about 25 people per showing. We have two tickets left to that. We have four showings, one on Saturday, three on Sunday afternoon and into the evening. And then we have a big showing Monday night at a theater just around the corner from her apothecary called Broovies. So Monday night, skip FHE and go to Broovies to watch a documentary on the psychedelic origins of Mormonism. 40-minute documentary. You're going to see Alex in it. You're going to see Cody in it. You're going to see me in it. You're going to see Bryce Blankenagel. You're going to see Marinda. And you are going to hear all sorts of awesome things. You aren't going to hear everything because we are going to go far more in depth on certain aspects of it in this interview right now.
And don't forget to tell them about the showings in Portland, too.
Oh, yeah, there's a showings in Portland. Thank you very much, okay? Because those tickets are lagging a bit. We're still selling, but it's not like it's not going gangbusters like Salt Lake right now. So Portland, May 11th in Portland. We are selling tickets, by the way. I think we're about halfway done, but we'd love to get rid of all of them if we can. At a theater called Fifth Avenue Cinema, you can get tickets at searstonedproductions.com. And so we'd love to see.
And by selling, he means free, too.
Oh, yeah, they're free. So, yeah.
Free tickets.
Yeah, what am I doing? I'm saying selling. Maybe you're selling your soul by going, but I shouldn't joke about that. You're not. But we are giving away free tickets. These are free tickets. It's amazing. So this is all part of a bigger project where really this is a proof of concept. It's just an introduction to the subject. And we are trying to pitch a multi-part documentary series and a scripted series. And that's what's exciting today. Alex, Cody, and I have a really... I don't want to overplay it, but we have a cool meeting that's going to happen later today, and we'll see where it goes right after we wrap up this podcast. So if we don't get through all the content, it's because we had to stop because we have this call, and then we'll have a second part for this to continue this information that Alex is going to be sharing. By the way, this information is part of a lecture that he gave last year, the weekend of May 15th, I think it was. We shot the documentary and we had a symposium. After day one of shooting, we went to a place called Industry Salt Lake where we had a public symposium. About 100 people were there. We gave three or four lectures. Alex gave one of them. This is the lecture that he gave, but with also new learnings that he's developed in the year since and new insights. So if you weren't able to attend that event, or if you were, it's going to be loads of information you're going to learn right now about Joseph Smith's family, magical ties. And that's what we're going to go into right now. So with that, Alex, let's take it away. Tell us a bit about you just as a precursor, if people haven't heard the previous episode you were in here.
So I have degrees in philosophy. I did my master's thesis on the nature of healing and psychedelic experience. I've worked as a Mormon historian for a few years. I've written curriculum for psychedelic therapy for clinicians. I've taught a course on philosophy and psychedelics. Worked as a researcher at ketamine clinics. So all things psychedelic and Mormon.
All right. Just to say it, what I like to say, and I don't know who's like big into Mormon history, this or modern history projects that are going on and who's doing the research. But when you say you're doing Mormon history, you are working with a lot of the key, for lack of a better way of saying it, active believing Mormons that are publishing material that are in like more or less Mormon approved, Latter-day Saint approved publishings. Is this correct?
Yeah.
Okay. So, all right. So Alex, you have a really cool angle. This is one of the reasons why I love talking to you, is because your understanding of Mormonism is very, 360 or beyond, where you can see the multiple perspectives, how to frame it for a believing Mormon and somebody who is completely outside the faith, for them to both understand and appreciate it and accept it as legitimate research, most of all, and further their thinking into new ideas that they may not otherwise be open to. So that's a compliment.
Thanks.
All right. Well,
you get started.
Yeah, let's get started. And, you know what? Are you cool with sharing it, even if people can't see it? So I could see your lecture. There's a share button at the bottom of the screen.
Let's see.
I don't know if you have that option. Actually, maybe only I can share.
No, I did.
Can you see it? Okay, not yet.
Oh, you can't. It says I'm sharing my screen.
No.
What?
Okay. I will just
try it again. I'll try it one more time.
Okay.
And for anybody who wants it, shoot me an email and I can, my contact form, my website, it's just alexcriddle.com, and I'll send you the PowerPoint or whatever.
alexcriddle.com, alexcriddle.com. Yeah. Look in the show notes. It will
all
be
right,
there.
Can you see that
there.
Now?
Yeah, I can see it now.
Uh-huh. All right, perfect. All right. So my lecture is titled Joseph Smith's Psychedelic Ancestry. So the goal here was to show that essentially, you know, Joseph Jr. existed within the context of his father's sort of quest and search for wisdom, and his mother searching for this sort of change of heart, you know, this transformation in the face of death that she experienced. And so the goals with this presentation are kind of just to give a general elucidation of, you know, the psychedelic knowledge that the Smith family had, from their known connections to occultism, to Masonry, Native American lore, and to place Joseph's first psychedelic vision in the context of his parents' visionary quests, and then to also, you know, frame the psychedelic experiences of both Joseph Sr. and Lucy Mack into their larger life stories. So to start, we'll kind of talk about Joseph Smith's occult and alchemical heritage. So Joseph, you know, he was a treasure seeker and a scryer, was intimately familiar with the Enochian tradition that came from the famed John Dee and Edward Kelly, who all the recent research into it has suggested that they likely were utilizing DMT in their scrying work. And they actually explicitly talk about using drugs such as henbane and datura and these other nightshades. But in one account, Kelly wrote to Dee that, "I've forgotten all of my drugs behind me, but since I know that you're well stored with sufficient ointments, I do intend to visit you with their help."
Okay. I don't intend on stopping you on every slide, okay? But I do want to just establish this up front and ask a few questions. I know this is going to derail you for a bit, but so don't answer all of them, because some of them are going to be later. But there are many things I have about this. I want to first, like, okay, what is meant by scryer?
So a scryer essentially is somebody who looks into a mirror or a glass or an obsidian, you know, stone, kind of like a seer stone. They look into this instrument and see, you know, angels, spirits, or whatever. Or they also, you know, are the people who are in tune with the other world and kind of bring it back and write.
Okay. And then a treasure seeker. What kind of treasure, if you can elaborate, what kind of treasure and how are they seeking it?
I mean, any kind of treasure, you know, buried pirate treasure, just buried random jewels, caches of money, that sort of thing. And I mean, the instruments that they use are all sorts. I mean, you could use like a divining rod to help find, you know, water as a treasure or just general treasure. And then you need the specific sort of tools to set up the ritual. You know, there's the account of Joseph Smith Sr. putting up stakes in the circle around the space. And like the Smiths had, you know, the Mars dagger, which likely was a ceremonial dagger used for these sorts of endeavors.
Okay. So. And then one more question on this slide and we'll go on and it won't, I'll try not to stop you for a few slides. Where is, if they were using DMT, where is it possibly coming from?
Acacia trees likely, or like honey locust trees. Those, I mean, they grow in the United States. There's acacia with DMT content in it. So that's a possibility.
And is there acacia in England at the time? Or anywhere that England is connected to, because England is becoming a massive empire and can be importing things from other places. Is there any reason to believe it will be coming from acacia for John Dee and Edward Kelly?
For John Dee and Edward Kelly? Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. There was all sorts of trade routes and all sorts of stuff there.
Okay. So
that's a whole different thing though.
They had all sorts of trade routes, but then I was asking about John Dee, but then you also answered the question for Joseph Smith.
Yeah.
So, okay. All right. So all these things, John Dee and Edward Kelly, seem to tie directly to Joseph Smith. You don't have to work very hard to see that this has connections to what Joseph Smith was doing.
Yeah.
Okay.
So, and the Smith family, we're also familiar with Henry Cornelius Agrippa, who in the 1500s, he named, you know, henbake, mandrake, which are both anticholinergics like Datura, and black poppy as three herbs that are under the power of Jupiter. And, you know, Joseph was undoubtedly familiar with the power of Jupiter, considering he carried a Jupiter talisman on his person. And we know that, you know, Joseph's family, they pulled that talisman image from Francis Barrett's The Magus, and Francis Barrett relied heavily on Agrippa. And Barrett in The Magus talks about henbane and black poppy being among the herbs used to invoke the images of the spirits through these proper suffumigations that had, you know, henbane, black poppy, hemlock, mandrake root, and other, you know, psychedelic plants. And these suffumigations have been one of the primary methods of, you know, interacting with, giving offerings to, and working with spirits all throughout occult and religious history. You know, think like incense in the Mosaic Tabernacle, for example.
So suffumigation, we're talking about burning it and breathing in the smoke. Is that what we're saying? Yes. Yep. Okay.
Yeah. So then there's a fellow, really brilliant scholar, Hereward Tilton, who's argued in his works that, you know, psychoactive substances were central to the Rosicrucian and alchemical traditions that were inherited essentially by the folk magicians in the early United States. And that's who the Smiths were familiar with. And so many of, you know, these anticholinergics that we talk about the Smiths using are all over the place in medieval and early modern magical fumigations, which involved, you know, burning the herbs, incense, and plants to, you know, summon angels, demons, the spirits of the dead, all the sort of stuff that Joseph did.
Okay, so in these books, they're talking about how to burn and ingest the chemicals, but also how to do rituals to summon angels or spirits or whatever you want to call them. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, exactly.
Okay.
So, like, for one example, you know, Agrippa cites this passage from Marcello di Ficino's De Vita about attracting the spirits of the stars with fumigations. And he listed a bunch of psychoactive fumigations from the medieval Sefer Raziel, which contained the spirit herbs like henbane, datura, and hemlock. And for Agrippa, you know, these practices were part of the central theme in Agrippa's magic to sort of ascend towards self-deification, which we know was the apotheosis of Joseph's theology, you know, to become gods ourselves. So, and then we have, you know, Joseph Smith's usage of the Urim and Thummim, translating the golden plates, kind of parallels this Rosicrucian usage of objects that were also called the Urim and Thummim, inscribing these spiritual or hidden texts. And, you know, there was psychedelic fumigations in these scrying practices. Joseph's doing the same thing as them. So, you know, Joseph also had this usage of the serpent cane engraved, the cane engraved with a serpent, that, you know, it parallels this Gnostic and Rosicrucian imagery of the spiraling serpent in a journey to sort of ascend to these celestial realms. And this motif is found in references to psychedelics like throughout history. And here, you know, Joseph's using a cane with, which is just another connection of his to the Rosicrucian sort of psychedelic movement.
So question on that. Okay. So the cane wasn't just for walking or for style. It had symbols in it. Okay. Well, it served that purpose too, because he walked with a limp or whatever it is we hear, but it's that, it's not just like symbols on it. Would that actually be used presumptively in occult practices?
I don't see why not.
Okay. All right.
Yeah. So that's a brief introduction to the connections of occultism. So now we'll kind of move over to Masonry and Joseph and his family's connection to Masonry. So, you know, Masonry, while it kind of existed in the 1600s, was officially organized by most accounts in 1717. And central to, you know, Masonry is this Hiram, the myth of Hiram Abiff's murder. He was the chief architect of the construction of the Temple of Solomon. And essentially during this time, you know, three Masons sort of ambushed him, and they demanded to know the secret of the Master Mason ability. And he wouldn't give it to him, of course, so they killed him. And in traditional imagery, he's buried under this acacia sprig. Acacia contains DMT. And so in the myth, you know, as Solomon, you know, Solomon's distraught by Hiram Abiff's death, and, you know, he goes to where he's buried and reaches down. And as Solomon feels under the ground to find Hiram, you know, he feels Hiram's hand and supposedly uses the grips of the Master Masons to raise the corpse. And, you know, given that the root bark of acacia has the highest DMT content, some think, you know, that this is symbolic of this ritualized acacia harvest of gaining sort of DMT. But with the death of Hiram Abiff, Solomon declares, you know, the secret word of the Master Masons lost. Although in continental masonry, the secrets aren't lost, but are actually inscribed on Hiram's grave, and acacia is part of Hiram's grave. So that's kind of interesting.
Yeah. Okay. So this person has been referenced before in previous episodes, probably in the episode that we had before where I talked to you. P.D. Newman is the source to read on this.
Yeah.
He's a current Freemason, Rosicrucian. He's current researcher. He's aware of the Mormon research that's happening on the psychedelic use, and a friend of Cody as well. And so his read book, his stuff.
Angels in Vermilion talks about the DMT and Rosicrucianism. And then Alchemically Stoned is this book that talks about Freemasonry and psychedelics. So, yeah, really great stuff. So going back to just masonry in general, so in history, you know, there's a Count Alessandro Cagliostro's Egyptian rite of 1784. And in this rite, the initiates drink what's called the prima materia, or the DMT containing acacia. And that's what gives them access to the infinities, you know. It's referred to as this the first matter in this alchemical operation that resulted in a crystalline salt, you know, the same form DMT is after it's extracted, and that's mixed into a drink. And of course, you know, we know Joseph and his love of Egyptian stuff has connections there. But essentially, so after this crystalline salt's been mixed into the drink, the candidate drinks this to, quote unquote, raise his spirit to be able to understand the concepts explained to him in the following speech. And, you know, Joseph would do this, you know, in the June 1831 conference, many other instances, they're told he gives them this drink so that they drink the sacrament so that then they can understand, you know, what's to come kind of thing. He gives this speech so they'll understand it. And they're all told that this will give them essentially knowledge of the Infinities. So, you know, further Masonic connections of the Smiths is Hiram. So Joseph's brother was originally spelled with an I, which is the same spelling of Hiram Abiff. His teacher at Dartmouth was John Smith, who was a master mason and a scholar of ancient Greece. At the time, there was a growing interest in the ancient order of things and the mysteries of Eleusis as being this visionary brew that would have been taught to Hiram. John Fellows, who was a historian of masonry at the time, wrote explicitly about how the Masons were trying to link the ancient orders of the Greeks and Egyptians to masonry. And so John Fellows writes, you know, it, meaning this drug, was given to the initiated at Eleusis to aid the impression of those mystic visions which passed before them. For that something like this was done, that is, giving medicated drugs to the aspirants, we are informed by Plutarch. And then he links sort of the ceremonies of masonry with the Catholic Church and says that those are derived from ancient institutions. So we have explicit connections that during Joseph's life and prior to his life, that the Masons were connecting their own rituals with the ancient rites of Eleusis using psychedelic drinks.
And then this can also be confirmed with modern research, very modern, with Brian Murarescu just did that same research, and you can read about it extensively in a very mainstream book, The Immortality Key.
Yeah, exactly. So now a brief introduction to Native American use of psychedelics. And obviously we could go way deeper on all of this, but no time. So we know that Joseph Smith was familiar with Native American lore, and he's clearly interested in it, you know, given the Book of Mormon was addressed to the Native Americans and was about them. He and his family lived near many tribes of the Iroquois Confederacy. There's a lot of interesting research there. His mother talks about how he sort of regaled the family with tales that he learned from the Native Americans. And then we know that the Native Americans around Joseph were using psychedelics and had been throughout their past. The Northeastern Native Americans, like the Algonquins, especially, who Joseph was next to, they would add datura and other powerful substances to tobacco to prepare a particularly potent smoke for visions. And we know Joseph and the School of the Prophets were smoking particularly potent tobacco. Could be that. excuse me. But also, nearly all of the Northeastern tribes used datura as the base of this drink that was used in manhood initiation rites. Beverly, in his History of Virginia, talks about extensively about the Algonquin use of datura in their rituals. And what's interesting is Beverly connects their drink, which was supposed to help them forget. He says that the Native Americans would drink so much of that water of Lethe that they would perfectly ignore remembrance of all former things. The river of Lethe is the Greek river of forgetfulness in the underworld, which is a direct link to the Eleusinian mysteries, which is centered around Demeter and Persephone, you know, wife of Hades, god of the underworld. And so the fact that Beverly is linking it to ancient Greece is kind of interesting.
Not it is interesting.
Anything, but it's interesting.
I haven't heard that before. Linking Native American psychedelic use to ancient Greece?
Just like that they're similar in function.
Yeah. Kind of yes. But serving the same purpose, that mythology is mythology. It's all symbols for the same things, just different words to describe the things, same things amongst different cultures, including Native Americans and Greeks, ancient Greeks, apparently. Okay.
There's also, we have history of entheogenic use of Amanita muscaria among like the Algonquins, documented by Jesuit clergy in there who as early as 1626 is when they were there. So we know that they were using Amanita muscaria, which will become particularly relevant in just a moment. So now we'll kind of turn to Joseph's family. But first we got to start with the aunts that he never met. So Lucy Mack had twin older sisters, Levisa and Levina. So Levisa Mack was sick for many years and it baffled all of the doctors. And Levisa became so ill that her family began preparing for her death. And they were essentially told that she couldn't be healed. But one night, you know, Levisa had this dream. She dreamed a dream of a sort of wine that would cure her, this medicated wine. It was immediately made and brought to her. And it we don't have a record of what the recipe was, but it's particularly interesting because as soon as she drank it, she fell into this vision, and she had this vision of Jesus, and she was miraculously cured. And so she spent the next years of her life saying, you know, God has raised me up, and I've come to tell you to prepare for death. And she talks about this experience where she was born away into the worlds of spirits, and she saw Jesus as though through a veil, which appeared to her as a spider's web. So there's sort of like this fractal imagery that you get in like psychedelic spaces that connects there. And, you know, during this vision, Jesus spoke and kind of told her to warn others to prepare for death, like I said, but also that because all must die to be reborn. So there's sort of this death rebirth experience. It's a, you know, a common theme among psychedelics. Soon after that experience, the other twin sister, Levina, contracted consumption and was essentially preparing for death. And her sister Levina died when Lucy was 13. And then a few years later, Levisa died. And as Levina was dying, she gathered her family around her and told them that they needed to have, you know, this miraculous change of heart, just like she'd had, you know, through these visionary experiences. And Lucy was apparently distraught by her sister's death. And so she went and stayed with her brother Stephen for a few years, who lived in Tunbridge and owned a tavern. And so, but what's particularly interesting here is that while at the Mac home, you know, Lucy wrote in her journal that she became determined to obtain that which she'd heard spoken of, you know, this change of heart. She ended up marrying before she could experience this change of heart, and her new husband's religious views didn't focus so much on spiritual rebirth, which we'll get to in just a moment.
Quick thing. What is consumption? She contracted consumption.
Tuberculosis.
Okay. All right, cool.
Yeah. So now we're going to turn to beer, and the Smith and Mac family is brewers. So we know Lucy's brother, Stephen, owned a very large tavern in Tunbridge, and Lucy Mac, of course, grew up with tavern experience with her brother, Stephen, and her sister, Lydia, who she had a close relationship with, inherited and ran a tavern. She appears to have met her husband, Joseph Sr., at the tavern. And we know that she continued to rely on her tavern experience years after she left Vermont. You know, when they first moved to Palmyra, New York, she started a cake and beer shop, which commanded brisk sales for her beer. When Lucy later lived in Missouri, you know, this is after Word of Wisdom, all that stuff, she considered her business that of keeping the tavern. And Mark Staker, he's the historian who's done the most work on this, has concluded that the Mac family were multi-generational tavern keepers and beer brewers. They also were hops farmers. They were the first cash crop grown in the family town of Tunbridge, Vermont. Joseph Smith Sr. and his brother Jesse were both experienced coopers and could construct the barrels and hogshead required for beer making. And recent archaeological work by Mark Staker and Don Enders at the Smith Homestead indicated that they did farm hops and that they did brew beer. So that's pretty cool.
I never put this together. I didn't know Joseph Smith Sr. was a cooper, because that could play in later with what they were holding wine in other instances. Because
yeah, that's possible.
Anyway, all right, interesting.
So, but the question then is, you know, what does beer have to do with psychedelics? Well, the historical craft of brewing beer included not only just water, hops, and barley, you know, as the Bavarian Purity Law of 1516, in which the German nobleman tried to say, no, beer's only water, hops, and barley. You can't add anything else. When throughout history, actually, any number of spices and herbs have been added to improve taste, act as medicine, and make it more intoxicating. Like, for example, Christian Roch points out that there's at least 50 known psychoactive plants that have been added to beer throughout the history of it. And there's some more famous ones, you know, the mandrake beer of the Egyptians, the corn beer of the South American Indians, which was flavored with seeds from Datura. And, you, of course, you know, the true Pilsner of the Germans, henbane beer. So beer brewing included all of these different plants and herbs. And so clearly the Smiths had the knowledge to work with plants and herbs and to brew beer, but also, you know, to work with psychedelics.
I remember hearing, this is a story like 10, 12 years ago, they heard it on NPR. There was, and so I'm, you know, I can't give you the source exactly for it, but was talking about this story of the first known recipe that was ever found was from ancient Egypt, and it was a beer recipe. And they're like, ha, 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 even the Egyptians like to get drunk. And it's like, they weren't making Bud Light.
They were making the good kind of beer.
Yeah.
The very psychoactive beer. Let's see. Okay, so further knowledge of the Smiths, you know, being able to work with herbs is Joseph Sr. In 1803, he, you know, he identified, harvested, and processed some like $4,500 worth of ginseng, trying to sell it to Chinese markets. And at that time, ginseng was attributed with these quote unquote secret and magical powers and supposedly had mild like psychoactive effects. So, you know, the Smiths are processing hops and other herbs into beers. They're using herbs and magical practices. They're crystallizing ginseng. You know, it suggests that the Smiths were dealers of psychoactives. They're basically just drug dealers. A good kind, though. Yeah. All right. So, let's see. No, I guess we'll
but
move
you
to...
haven't, you haven't found any fentanyl connections to the Smiths?
Not yet. Pending investigation. Not very good practice to, you know, kill off your customers.
Yeah, that's true. It's true, especially if you want a lot of believers.
Although, I guess, I mean, it works for the big cigarette companies.
Ah, that's true. That's true.
But, you know, now they're getting into vapes and shit. So they just switch markets every generation. Try something new. Bastards. All right. So, of course, now that we've talked about the drugs, we got to talk about the visions on the drugs. This one's particularly fun, you know. So Solomon Mack, Joseph Jr.'s maternal grandfather. The poor guy, like, he was so accident prone. He had multiple trees fall on his head while he was clearing land. Like, not just one. It happened three different times, you know. And on two of these different occasions, they nearly killed him because they hit him on the head. Like, how the hell does that – how do you have three different trees fall on your head? Like, and then other times in his autobiography, he talks about falling off a horse and having a horse drag him and banging his head around. It's like this poor guy, you know, probably had traumatic brain injuries. And, you know, such traumatic injuries, you know, they can cause epilepsy. And, you know, throughout – after these events, Solomon Mack talks about having seizures all the time. So it probably did trigger, you know, this form of epilepsy in him. But so what's interesting is at the leading treatment for epilepsy at the time, according to all these different medical textbooks, was Datura stramonium, where they talk about how all epileptic cases were checked and suspended while the patients were under the influence of Datura. And they never returned until the remedy was suspended. And so there's professors at the Yale College who were talking about it as a radical cure for epilepsy. And they would keep patients for months under its influence. So months. Okay, so
they would stay on it the whole time. And once they would stop, once the medication would run out, then they'd start experiencing the symptoms again. So they'd constantly have to be on Datura. Okay.
Pretty much, yeah. This was being used at the time, and Datura was everywhere at the time. Like, throughout history, it was just this common weed that grew in everybody's yard. So everybody knew exactly what it was and probably how to use it, kind of thing. So Solomon Mack had epilepsy. He also had rheumatoid arthritis at the time, and it was during a particularly bad bout of rheumatism, arthritis, and epileptic seizures that he talks about like 1811, Solomon Mack starts having these visions. And he talks about having these bouts of paranoia just prior to the visions. He talks about this light coming towards him and these beings and whatnot, and this eventual relief, which are all common side effects of Datura, and actually are reminiscent of, you know, his grandson Joseph's first vision. And, you know, reminiscent of the light coming towards Joseph in his room at night. So I think, you know, Solomon Mack was probably using Datura, and that's what had caused these visions that he was having this fall, this one fall and winter when he converted to Christianity. Because prior to that, you know, he was the staunch atheist. But then he converted after these visions, and it likely was from Datura. And the town doctor at the time, Jabez Cowdery, Oliver Cowdery's grandfather, you know, was particularly known for using Datura and being an incredible healer. So,
okay. So, but Datura for epilepsy, you know, is one thing. From the little that I know, Datura has other medical conditions that it can help treat. Is that correct?
Yeah. Arthritis. I talked about that.
Oh, you talked about arthritis. Okay. But so arthritis.
It's used for all sorts of stuff. Yeah. I mean, like any, even today, you know, there's people using it for like autoimmune disorders and stuff.
Okay. Okay.
So like these compounds are widely used still.
And if it was used at the time, then there's a possibility that it was prevalent in the community and
was prevalent in the community.
Okay. All right.
Yeah, so it was everywhere.
May have had an influence on people's
openness, it was in people's
and perception
beer.
To spirituality or the other world or whatever.
Yeah. Yeah, okay. Exactly.
All right. You
know, predisposed. Oh, yeah. And I forgot, Solomon quotes talking about how he had a mighty change of heart, you know, during this time, which is reminiscent of, you know, Levinas' call for a mighty change of heart, which is kind of cool. So that's Joseph's grandpa. Now we got to talk about his parents. So Lucy, around 1803 or 1804 in Tunbridge, had this experience. It's called Lucy's Dream, where she talks about how she's kind of depressed in spirit because Joseph Sr. and her aren't agreeing on, you know, religious things. And she talks about how she was pretty depressed and she was like, okay, well, I'm going to go to bed. And soon after, she fell asleep and had this following dream. So in this dream, she talks about being in this meadow, which is just near the house that they're living in at the time in Tunbridge. And everything around her had this peculiar pleasantness, she says. There was this magnificent meadow, this very pure and clear stream of water that ran through the middle of it. And there were two trees standing on its margins. And she talks about how these trees were beautiful. They were well proportioned and majestic. Their branches added to their symmetry and glory. They were grand, and she gazed upon them with wonder and admiration. And after beholding them, a bright light surrounded one of them, which appeared like a belt of burnished gold, but far more brilliant. Presently, a gentle breeze passed by, and the trees encircled with this golden zone bent gracefully and waved its branches in the air. And what's interesting is that these reports, or the words she used, you know, golden zone, golden ring, are common words used in Amanita muscaria trip reports. You know, they report a golden zone, a golden ring around objects. And other subjective effects, you know, where objects are animated, dancing, pulsing, breathing, you know, wavy motion in the visual field, an alive quality, symmetrical visuals, pleasant feelings, and a lightened mood. And now returning to Lucy's vision or Lucy's dream, she says that, you know, the trees assumed the most lively and animated appearance. You know, they seemed to express in their motions the utmost joy and happiness. If it had been an intelligent creature, it could not have conveyed the power of language, the idea of joy and gratitude so perfectly as it did. The stream would swell gently and recede again with the motion, or the trees would swell gently and recede again, you know, with a motion as soft as the breathing of an infant, but as lively as the dancing of a sunbeam. You know, the belt also partook of the same influence, and it moved in unison with the motion of the stream and the tree, and it continued to increase in refulgence and magnitude until it became exceedingly glorious, right? So we see, you know, the lively and animated, the joy and happiness, the moving, the breathing sort of pulsing imagery that is extremely common in Amanita muscaria and other psychedelic instances.
Yeah, I feel like even when you just do a fairly light dose of mushrooms, the psilocybin mushrooms, these effects are prevalent. These are some of the first visual effects that you see when you're, when you're doing psilocybin.
And it's important to note, you know, Amanita muscaria is an oneirogen. You know, it's a meaning it's like a dream substance. You take the Amanita muscaria, and most people fall asleep, and then they have their vision in a dream. So that corresponds with, you know, what Lucy's saying, where she is desiring this sort of something better to happen to her. She's depressed in spirit. You know, maybe she's depressed and knows how to use herbs to help her, whatever. But the fact that she talks about falling asleep and having this vision is pretty similar. Or is directly in line with Amanita muscaria usage.
Yeah. Okay. I'm curious to see where you go from here. I have a lot of questions on that, but let's keep going.
So as it so happens, I've been to the Smith family's Tunbridge home. I went there September of 2022 with my friend Don Bradley. We were doing Mormon research, and we go to the Smith family's Tunbridge home. You know, we see the foundation that Mark Staker and Don Enders dug out, kind of thing. And we see the meadow, and Don had to go pee. And so we went across the street to the forest. And we walked in the forest, and he starts yelling. He's like, "Alex, come here, come here." And I'm like, "What, what?" And so I run into the forest, you know, expecting something bad. And he's looking down on the ground, and I see this brilliant orange mushroom show up. And it's like the telltale signs of Amanita muscaria. Variant Gesawi, of course, because that's the variant in northeastern United States. But we're on the Smith family property. You know, we can see the wall, the rock wall that they built that's still there. And we're in this little wooded area, and there's just mushrooms, Amanita muscaria everywhere, just hundreds of them everywhere. It was crazy.
Did you go there with any, was it a possibility in your mind that you were going to find that, or was it a complete surprise?
Possibility. Yeah.
Okay. Okay.
I mean, yeah, dream come true.
did you think in the moment, right, I mean, I know you understood the significance of it, but like every time I hear that story, I'm like, this is like, I mean, like anybody that's listening, please perk up your ears right now. Please, please, please. You know, I know we went through a lot of heavy stuff just now that requires a lot of reading, a lot of vocabulary to understand, but this right here, this one is very important. Please listen.
Yeah, I mean, there's predictive power because these substances should still be around wherever, you know, the Smiths were, and they are clearly. We even sent the mushroom out to get it tested, you know, make sure this is Amanita muscaria variant Gesawi. And it was. We sent it to the Rutgers plant lab. But, you know, one thing, you know, we want to do in the future is an archaeological dig, because like we talked about earlier, Mark Staker and Don Enders dug out this foundation. They got down to the level of the soil that exists when the Smiths were there, and they did a pollen analysis to figure out the type of hops that the Smiths were growing there, like that exact year kind of thing. And we'd like to do the same thing with spore analysis of mushrooms to prove that Amanita muscaria was on the property when the Smiths were there in the early 1800s.
So with that, okay, can you technically use the same soil that you already used to show the presence of hops, to show the presence of Amanita muscaria, or do you have to go back again?
I don't know if they still have the soil or what the status of it is.
All right, so if anybody wants to buy a plane ticket for Alex to go out to the Tunbridge family farm to look this up.
I need Mark Staker too, because he's the guy who did the soil analysis, and he knows the level of the soil that you'd have to take the sample from.
Okay, so we need him too, and if anybody wants to fund this trip, alexcriddle.com, reach out to him so we can get this done, because so many times, despite all the evidence that's been shown to this point, people say, well, what's the smoking gun? Tell me where the smoking gun is. Okay, now that won't be a smoking gun for everybody, but it's closer. It's getting pretty close, and there are still more opportunities.
You know, if anybody has access to a lock of Joseph Smith's hair or any of the other early saints, you know, we can run tests on that and see what psychedelic compounds were present in their hair. Which I know the church has locks of Joseph Smith hair. I've seen it.
You've seen it in person or a photo of it?
Yeah. I've seen it in person.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, man. Okay. So,
but yeah, we need a single strand so we can test it.
So a single strand of Joseph Smith's hair, making a shout out for that. A barrel, because the Smith family, they were coopers. If you have a barrel from the Smith family, if you have a smoking pipe from the School of the Prophets, if you have any relics from the Kirtland Temple dedication, alexcriddle.com. Please contact him. Or if you have money so we can do a little Indiana Jones work and hunt these down himself,
yeah,
please let
us
know.
And I've got a guy, a guy and a lab who will test these, who is a professional. It's the same guy, you know, the guy that worked for Brian Murescu's book, testing old sacrament cups from, you know, third century Christians and BC Christian or BC Greek artifacts. So, like, it's a legit lab. We've got all the tests. We have all the equipment, all the safety protocols. We just need access.
So if this isn't enough evidence for whoever's listening out there, or for a friend of theirs or a family member, they want the smoking gun and you can help them out, please, again, one more appeal. That's alexcriddle.com.
Ooh, or anybody who doesn't think it's the case, get access so that we can test it and prove us wrong.
Okay.
I will happily change my opinion if I get access to that stuff.
So if you have a cup from the sacrament of the Kirtland Temple and you don't want to believe it and you want to wash it with a little bit of soap and a good rinse before you give it to Alex, we'll test it for modern soap compounds and psychoactive substances.
Yeah, exactly. So back to the subject matter. The outcome of Lucy's vision, you know, it ended with her mood lightened, which, you know, psychedelics do help with that. And she concluded that, you know, when Joseph was more advanced in life, he would hear the pure gospel and, you know, basically come around. And, well, a few years later, Joseph Sr. would have this happen through his own psychedelic experiences. So this happened about 1810 in Royalton, Vermont. This is one and two of a series of seven visions of Joseph Sr.'s. So prior to this, you know, Lucy reports in her history that her husband's mind was excited upon the subject of religion. You know, he wouldn't subscribe to any particular faith, but he contended for the ancient order of things. You know, just like Joseph Smith would say, you know, restoring the gospel. Joseph Sr. was, you know, on this same sort of wisdom quest. You know, Lucy Mack was seeking this change of heart. She wants it also for her husband. And her husband is seeking, you know, the ancient order of things, just like Joseph would, just like the Masons were, just like the Rosicrucians were doing. You know, all of this, you know, ties back to the ancient order stuff. I've got a paper I'm working on, you know, Joseph Smith functioning basically as a hierophant in the ancient order, linking it all together, which I'll have to, that'll post on my website once I finish it. It's great.
Okay. If Alex says it's great, it is great because Alex, like Cody, they're very, very quiet about the research that they do and critical of their own stuff all the time. And it's like, if Alex says this is a great paper, seek it out.
Oh, thanks, Brandon. Yeah. So Joseph Sr., seeking the ancient order of things. In 1810, you know, he relates this to his wife, this dream that he had, which she referred to as his first vision. And he talks about how he seemed to be traveling in an open, barren field. He couldn't see anything but this dead fallen timber or whatever. You know, he's in this gloomy desert alone, with the exception of this attendant spirit. And he asked the spirit, you know, the meaning of what he was seeing and why he was traveling in such a terrible place. And if people know Joseph's or the story of Lehi Nephi in the Book of Mormon, some people say, you know, oh, well, maybe that dream was plagiarized from this dream, Joseph Sr.'s. Because Joseph Sr., you know, he asked the spirit what it means. And the spirit says, oh, well, the field is the world that's now inanimate and dumb in regard to the true religion or the plan of salvation. You know, but travel on and you'll find a certain log. And on this box, there will be some contents in it. And if you eat it, it'll make you wise and give unto you wisdom and understanding, you know, just like the fruit of the tree. But here, you know, Joseph's seeking this, doing this wisdom quest. So he took the box immediately with eagerness, raised the lid and began to eat its contents. And at this time, you know, all manner of beasts and horned cattle and roaring animals rose up on every side of him and they were threatening him. and he was compelled to drop the box and run away with his life. But he talks about, in the midst of all this terror, he's like, I was perfectly happy, even though I woke trembling with fear, kind of thing. Like, oh, yeah, you know, I got my wisdom. Like, that's awesome. So I got to make a quick interjection here, remember, of Joseph Sr. and his Masonic influences, right? So the murder of Hiram Abiff rendered the secret of the master's word, wisdom, as lost. You know, Joseph Sr. and many of the early Mormons believed that the myth of Hiram Abiff was literal. And so Joseph Sr. was literally searching for the lost word, wisdom, which is this thing that he found when he ate, you know. And okay. The master's word was lost, and this wisdom is a symbolic also of divine truth and wisdom.
And I think you're going to make this clear, but you referenced James 1:5 earlier.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. You know. So, let's see. Okay, yeah. We'll come back to the masonry stuff in a second, I guess. So the outcome of Joseph Sr.'s first vision is that he was confirmed more than ever, according to Lucy, that there was no order of class or religion who knew more concerning the kingdom of God, you know? So nobody had the ancient order of things, just like Joseph thought. So then he has the second dream a year later in New Hampshire, where he says, you know, I thought I was traveling in an open, desolate field, which was very barren. My guide stood by me and said, desolate world, but travel on. So he kept traveling on, and he found this tree. And it was exceedingly handsome, insomuch that I looked upon it with wonder and admiration. Its beautiful branches spread themselves somewhat in the form of an umbrella, and it bore a kind of fruit, in shape much like a chestnut burr, and as white or whiter than snow. You know, so that sort of description describes exactly, you know, a Datura seed pod. If you look at a Datura seed pod and a chestnut burr right next to each other, they're incredibly similar. Datura's got, you know, the white seeds in it. Although our friend Evan Charlie, she's brought up that, you know, that also could describe the fledgling stage of a Amanita muscaria mushroom. So that's also a possibility.
It's true. It's true. And I am torn on that. I am torn. Although when I read this, you tweeted, the first time I came across you, it was like 200 tweets that you made in a row that basically broke down this story in tweet form. And it, the chestnut burr thing, I had read that, but I'd never seen pictures. And I think you referenced it. You had some links to some, or I looked it up at the same time. Can't remember. I'm like, what? I did not know this.
Yeah, it's pretty cool. So Joseph Sr.'s second vision continues. You know, he gazed upon this fruit with considerable interest. The burrs began to open, and the fruit within them was dazzling whiteness, just like the tree of life. You know, and as I drew near and began to eat of it, I found it delicious beyond description. And as I was eating, you know, I want my wife and children to come partake of it. And we all commenced eating and praising God for this blessing because we were super happy. And, you know, of course you're going to be happy when you're getting the secret lost word sort of thing, you know? And so all of this lines up with Lehi's vision of the tree of life. You know, desolate field, river of water, iron rod. Joseph Sr.'s has a rope running along the river, tree with dazzling white fruit. Both have spacious buildings, whatever. Both Lehi and Joseph Sr. ignore the mocking. The fruit represents the love of God. Both of them, they ate the fruit, they ingested in the substance, and went into their body, which filled them with joy and love, sort of thing. Now, what's interesting is Lehi's vision of the tree of life and the story of Joseph Sr.'s has all these interesting parallels with, like, masonry. And a lot of these are found kind of in Method Infinite by Cheryl Bruno, Joe Swick III, and Nick Letursky. Brilliant book. But they point out, you know, the Book of Mormon begins at the same time as the Royal Arch degree, the Reign of Zedekiah. The Royal Arch degree uses both Moses and the burning bush, the idea of a prophetic theophany, and the return and recovery of truth. You know, the Book of Mormon, Lehi is the principal sojourner that exists in masonry, and, you know, saw a vision before the Tree of Life. Both cases, the temple rebuilt. Nephi's trip into Jerusalem is a reversal of the Masonic legend of a cure-up. And then, you know, you can compare the seeking the lost wisdom of Hiram Abiff with Joseph Sr. seeking the lost wisdom, and then Lehi and Nephi finding the wisdom, just like Joseph Sr. Lehi's son Nephi, quote-unquote Joseph Smith Jr., wanted to know the things that his father had experienced. And so he goes and asks God. And after Joseph Jr.'s first vision, you know, he came away with the outlook that none of the religions contained any more wisdom than another, just like Joseph Sr. Nephi's vision, you know, extends much further than his father's did. You know, Nephi sees the future of the Jews, the coming forth of the Book of Mormon, and Joseph Jr.'s vision quest for wisdom also went further than his father's, you know, culminating in Joseph Jr. establishing God's actual church that Joseph Sr. then becomes a part of. And so, you know, Mormonism really began with a son stepping into the visionary quest of his father. You know, Joseph Jr., like Nephi, stepped into the vision that his father sort of began and opened up. You know, they paved the way and the son came through and stepped into it.
This is so layered. You know, the fact like that Joseph Smith could create under whatever conditions he did, the Book of Mormon, which, as you just explained, could potentially be an explanation of his relationship with his father, and which is also paralleled in other mythologies going back to Freemasonry and the Bible. Like, this is very, very, very layered, and the idea that Joseph Smith created this book somehow is intriguing.
Yeah. And I mean, in another layer with the Tree of Life, the Tree of Life is wisdom. Well, you look at Proverbs 3, you know, happy is the man that findeth wisdom. She is a tree of life to them that they hold upon her, and happy is the one that retaineth her. Revelation 2, you know, to him that overcometh, I will give to eat of the tree of life. You know, to him that overcometh, will I give to eat of the hidden manna, and will give him a white stone. Like, so Joseph stepping into this wisdom quest, you know, Revelation 2, eating this hidden manna. I mean, Dan Merker and Benny Shannon and a bunch of other scholars, you know, have all argued that manna was actually like mushrooms, you know, like psychedelic mushrooms giving these visions. And so it's symbolic of saving, you know, the people's souls kind of thing, as well as their physical health. But there's all these layers, you know, of Joseph step, like there's this perennial wisdom quest, you know, this search for the divine, what's out there, and understanding, you know, what our historical predecessors have kind of figured out, our ancestors have figured out. And Joseph, you know, he was doing the exact same thing. And I mean, I stumbled into all of this stuff doing the exact same thing, you know, trying to understand divine truth and wisdom and whatever. Like, Joseph was stepping into something larger than himself. You know, his father sought wisdom. He received it not from religion, but from visions using psychedelics. His mom had wanted a change of heart and then the correct religion, and she got that from a vision. And all of this is sort of surrounding Joseph as he embarks on his first vision, which was likely facilitated by, you know, a psychedelic substance. So he wasn't only stepping into his parents' visionary quests. You know, he was stepping into the quests of all those who sought wisdom from the beginning of time. You know, Joseph even cites himself, you know, James 1:5 is what set him off. If any of you lack wisdom, let him ask of God. And Joseph writes, you know, if any person needed wisdom from God, I did. And I didn't know how to act. And unless I could get more wisdom than I had, I would never know. So, yeah, like Joseph's entire story is this initial quest for wisdom that he got from his parents. He got from, and they got it, you know, from Masonry, from Rosicrucianism, and from magical traditions, and even from, you know, his connections with the Native Americans. So yeah, that's the essence of the Smith story in my head. This is this pure quest for understanding the nature of things and wisdom and all that shit.
Okay, I was not expecting you to be able to do this, which you did in less than 45 minutes. Wait, do you have more to go through?
No.
Okay, all right. I do want to go through, you did skip a slide at the end that I noticed. I want to, because going back to, okay, you made a very compelling case in many, many regards on many, many levels. Okay, but also just for somebody that's hearing this, it may be like, well, what else do you have? Because you skipped a slide that had symptoms.
There's a taste of the symptomology of Joseph's first vision. You know, he describes having a dry mouth, the inability to speak. He says, you know, my tongue's cleaved to the roof of my mouth. He's blindness. He says he's blind as a bat in one account, and thick darkness gathered around him. Paralysis. He was seized upon by some power which entirely overcame him. And then another account, you know, the enemy which held me bound. There's paranoia and the fear of death. And then there's the resistance to ego dissolution before breaking through, you know. At the very moment when I was ready to sink into despair and abandon myself to destruction, I saw a pillar of light exactly over my head above the brightness of the sun. So there's a bunch more examples like that. But essentially, all of those things that I listed are symptoms of anticholinergic toxicity. And anticholinergics are the class of, you know, nightshades, Datura, Henbane, Belladonna, those sorts of drugs. So not only, you know, is there like this evidence that they knew about the herbs, you know, Joseph's own description of his vision contains references to the things, the symptoms and physical symptoms and the, you know, mental experiences that people have under the influence of psychedelics.
Okay. So, you know, I'm going to make a shout out right now for Gabe Pruhl's podcast that we just appeared on, Mystics and Muons, yesterday. And I don't know if that episode is going to come out, technically be posted before or after this one. Also, we're going to be having an interview either, I think, it's going to be Cody and me that get interviewed by Doug and Mike this weekend. I don't know when that's going to get posted, if it's before or after this episode. So I'm just calling a couple of these things out. And we're going to be promoting the documentary more in that episode with Doug and Mike. This reminds me of something that we were talking about with Gabe yesterday, where, you know, like there's all sorts of ways of explaining what happened in early Mormonism and talking about them as possibilities. And Joseph Smith may have been doing this or that to have revelation. It's like, oh, we can have conjecture. We can be like, oh, maybe he was meditating. Maybe he was doing some form of extreme exertion in some way, or maybe he was fasting, or maybe there was a little bit of alcohol used at some point. But yes, there are all of these things that may have happened. But and I know I'm like asking somebody that has an opinion on this, but like it's not really a fair question. I'm of the same opinion as you. So I'm just giving that as a disclaimer to the listener. But like, what is the difference between possibilities of what Joseph Smith was doing and it labeling psychedelics as a possibility of what he was doing, or saying, no, factually, Joseph Smith was using psychedelics? What's the distinction between those two?
Yeah, so a possibility is essentially, you know, evidence supports it. I mean, technically, you know, anything's possible sort of thing. But when I'm talking about possibility, I'm talking about like there is historical evidence suggesting that this was the case or linking Joseph to this and that. So this is, you know, a serious possibility that could have happened. We can never really say for 100% certainty on anything historical, you know, that, oh, this exactly happened and this is how it happened sort of thing. You know, we can say that, oh, Caligula was a Roman emperor and we have all of this evidence supporting it, you know, his image on coins and all this. So we can make, you know, that historical claim, or we can say, ancient Greeks used psychedelics in the Eleusinian Mysteries. And, you know, we've tested chalices from that are found in the temple that contain these substances. We can't recreate it, so we don't know for sure. But the probability that that is the case is extremely high. And I think that's the same sort of thing when we're talking about this with Joseph Smith. I think the probability that he used psychedelics and that his family did is extremely high. But it's not for certainty. It's a possibility, you know, and it's one of many possibilities. Like it seems like this is the case, but I could easily see it being the other way. And oh no, they didn't use psychedelics, like based on the visionary experiences, you know, there are multiple ways that this could have arisen.
Okay. Yeah. There are multiple ways that this could have happened now. But there is a lot of evidence pointing towards psychedelics. And then also, to me, the bigger thing is that a way that you can test this, and you're not going to find out for sure if Joseph Smith used psychedelics or not, even if this is the case. But the ultimate test is you can try the same you can try psychedelic substances yourself and see what happens and see if visions open up to you that are in any way similar to Mormonism. And if that happens, maybe that is also evidence that Joseph Smith may have been using the same key to revelation.
Not historical evidence, but, you know, it is evidence on sort of like a theological basis.
A theological basis. You can have an experience like Joseph Smith, like the one that Joseph Smith described, and it doesn't mean that you accessed it through the same means, but pretty strong evidence if you if you do try that.
I mean, especially, you know, go, and that's without this exact same set and setting, you know, go set up your ritual the exact same way he did, go do it in the sacred grove, and come back and tell me then, like, you saw God.
Right. Well, Alex, it was great talking to you. Now, tell me again, where can people get a hold of you? Or is there anything that you want to give a plug to? Oh, I want to give a plug right now for,
all right. For,
okay, Alex has some psychedelic philosophy courses that he's recorded. He also gives these live, and I don't know when you're going to do it again. I'm watching them recorded, and I am finding this, and it's not just because Alex is here. It's not just because Alex is my friend. But I find these to be the most fulfilling philosophical courses that I have ever partaken of. And so I am into psychedelics. I am casually into philosophy. I don't speak the philosophical language as well as the psychedelic language, but like this has an overlap with my particular interest that's extremely high. And people are listening to this podcast, I think, would also find this fascinating. I'm not even halfway through. I've listened to two of the five or are there six modules?
Six.
Okay. I'm only a third of the way through. And each time I watch them, I text Alex. I'm like, I want to talk about this. And I've been close to him and very lucky that I can actually talk to him after these courses, these modules, and get my questions personally answered. But
hey, anybody can.
Okay. All right. There's the invitation.
I'll talk to you. I'll answer all your questions.
So I'm going to plug those courses. Alex, tell them where they can find those and how they can get in touch with you just generally.
Oh, thanks. So the course is on my website, just alexcriddle.com. And you can contact me through there, or if you want, you can send me an email. My email is just alexcriddle and then the number 1@gmail.com. And yeah, shoot me questions, shoot me your crackpot theories, whatever. Or if you just want to talk about it.
I shoot Alex crackpot theories all the time on the phone.
They're pretty good. You got good crackpot theories.
So, and then they could also meet Alex in person the weekend of April 27th, that's Saturday, 28th and 29th. Saturday, Sunday, Monday, we have showings for Entheomagus, first at Natural Law Apothecary. That's one showing on Saturday night, three showings Saturday afternoon, and then one showing three showings Sunday afternoon, and one showing at Broovies, a pub theater around the corner at 6 o'clock on Monday. Two tickets left for Sunday, one of those sessions. And then Monday, there are tickets left for Broovies, but they're going quick. So go claim them. They are free. Free tickets. Searstoned Productions.com. Entheomagus is the name of the documentary. Alex, I almost said Brandon. Alex, me, Cody, Bryce, Marinda, all the people in the documentary will be there in person for a Q&A session after each showing. So be there. Talk to us. Meet us. Throw us ideas why you like it, why you don't. Whatever it is, it's your opportunity. We'd love to meet you. Oh, Cody won't be there Monday. He has to leave earlier. I don't know if Marinda will either. I'm not sure about Bryce, but Alex and I will be there Monday at Broovies for sure. So everybody else will be there at Marinda's on Saturday and Sunday. So I just want to clarify, just so you're not disappointed. I'm not doing false advertising. There's no ill intent there. All right. Go claim tickets, SearStoneProductions.com. Thank you so much, Alex. This was awesome.
Thank you.
All right. Well, I look forward to our call in a few minutes.
Yeah.
All right. Now give it. Now, hey, Mike.
Yeah.
Let's actually come up with an identity. Like, what's the name of the identity that you're going to read this one as?
His name is Cool Joe.
Cool Joe, baby. Here it comes. Ladies and gentlemen.
The first name that came to me when you said that was Patrick, but I want to read it as Patrick.
Dude, I'll do it as Patrick. You do it as Cool Joe.
Okay.
You ready?
Maybe you start it and I'll do the
next part. All right, here we go. You ready?
Yeah.
Thank you for listening. As a reminder, the very best way to support this podcast is to just head on over to patreon.com/Mormons on Mushrooms.
There you're going to find bonus content, fun episodes, other shit.
Girl, we're talking about shit you have not heard before.
Never. Mankind has never heard these things before. So go on over to Patreon. But we'd also love it if you gave us a review. Just head over to Apple and give us a quick love over there. Quick love. Quickie.
Just a little bit of love on Apple. Listen, if you're listening on Spotify, that's cool too. Put up a 5-star if you liked it. If you didn't, keep your mouth shut.
Just maybe put up a whoa, yo, Flavor Country.
We love Flavor Country. By the way, Mike and I also accept just free pure money, and you can do that at Venmo. Mike, hit him with the deets.
Just put them in our pocket. Just give us some money at Mushmore, M-U-S-H-M-O-R, on Venmo, and we'll use it to buy some kombuchas. Just have a good time.
M-U-S-H-M-O-R. What up? Peace.
Fucking yes.